Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what are the legal and political implications of federal troops occupying American cities without the local government's approval? What does it mean for democracy when an American president says that the police must dominate the streets? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Ever since the killing of George Floyd, the city of Portland has witnessed consistent protests and civic action demanding police reforms. But recently, camouflaged federal authorities without identification badges have begun arresting protesters. The Department of Homeland Security personnel then used unmarked SUVs to detain protesters. The White House has confirmed its order to send federal authorities to Portland and has threatened to send them to other American cities. Local elected officials, including the mayor of Portland, have demanded the federal agents leave the city. This raises federalism issues as well as distinct civil liberties concerns. On today's show, we will examine the developments in Portland, the White House decision to send federal authorities, and what this means for constitutional protections and control of policing decisions in the United States. Our panel today is David Meyer, professor of sociology, political science, and planning policy and design at the University of California, Irvine. He is author of The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. Nadine Strassen, John H. Marshall Harlan II, professor emerita at New York Law School and the former president of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's written extensively, including Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. And Jennifer Saline, Kinder Institute Associate Professor of Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri. She is author of The Best Laid Plans, How Administrative Burden Complicates Voting Rights Restoration, Law and Policy. Professor Meyer, we're going to start with you. What's been going on in Portland, and why has there been so much more attention in Portland during this period? What's been going on?
Portland has had protests like every other city in the United States has had protests, and it has its own troubled history of policing. The police department is controlled by a commissioner who's also mayor. He's been supervising the tear gassing of protesters, and they're protesting for racial justice as they have been everywhere. The mayor, Mayor Wheeler, said he was pretty sure that the protests were dying down and that they would have kind of ended on their own steam in about a week. Now, when we put this in a national context, there's a couple things that have nothing to do with what's going on in Portland that have a lot to do with the decision to send federal police. The numbers of COVID-19 infections and deaths has been spiking up. The story about bounties on American service people in Afghanistan is still percolating. And the economy has been, if not collapsing, at least deflating, as the first bailout bill for American workers is kind of expired at the end of this month. So there's reason for the administration to want a distraction. The Trump administration sent in unidentified federal troops. It appears that they're from the Border Patrol Police, from the TSA. They are not trained in crowd control or riots. They're not National Guard. And it seems quite likely that Trump knows the military would refuse the orders to go in. So you have young men in camouflage who are heavily armed and wearing masks and helmets taking to the streets of Portland ostensibly to protect federal buildings. And the initial reaction is pretty much what you'd expect. More Portlanders have gone out to protest. And so there have been scuffles in the street and some dramatic pictures. I've been interested in kind of the suburban character of Portland. So you have a group called the Wall of Moms, which was started on Facebook. And it's women who look like moms anyway. I'm sure some right-wing site is going to discover that one of them hasn't had a child. But going out to put their bodies between themselves and the young, mostly younger protesters. And they're wearing yellow and masks and goggles and bicycle helmets. And they've been gassed and beaten. a Navy veteran came out who had not been out at the protest, 53-year-old massive man who was beaten repeatedly, a man named Chris David, who said, "I was in the military, I served in the Navy, we're supposed to protect civil liberties." He was outraged. And that made national news. And then the latest thing is the deployment of the suburban terror device, the leaf blower. Men, dads in Portland have come out with leaf blowers to blow the tear gas away. And apparently it's effective. So what's been happening? More conflict in the street, more graffiti, more confrontation, and massive reports and documentation of protesters or passersby being swept up in rental cars and vans and taken away, questioned, released, not arrested, not read rights. And the Border Patrol police policing the border on the Portland streets. So it's a disruptive moment, which is getting more disruptive. How's that for a start?
Quite shocking, because Professor Strassen, what immediately came to mind to me were the civil liberties concerns, the idea that federal authorities who are unidentified, unmarked SUVs, et cetera. My initial response was this shouldn't be happening in America. How concerned should we be about the loss of civil liberties with this action?
Extremely concerned, and I'm happy to report that the American Civil Liberties Union did bring a lawsuit initially at the end of June against the Portland police force to stop it from what our particular focus was on, journalists and legal observers, both for the ACLU and the National Lawyers Guild and other neutrals who were there precisely to document police abuses, right? And I should also say that we immediately won an order from a federal court enjoining the Portland police from engaging in that kind of behavior. And they did stop. And there was a marked increase in the protest activity in the sense that people were no longer being deterred and intimidated from exercising their First Amendment rights, which they were when even neutral observers were being subject to unjustified, unwarranted arrests. Then the federal government came in with these, you know, people who say that they are enforcing federal law, but who knows? I mean, they're not identified in any way, including in through their clothing or through badges or identification. And the experience can be very much of being kidnapped in a police state or in a state without any law and order. So it's really terrifying and having a terrible impact. You know, it's the worst of both worlds, because not only are people reasonably being deterred from continuing to exercise their First Amendment rights, and I should stress the overwhelming majority of people who are participating are unquestionably merely exercising their First Amendment rights to peaceably assemble. There is no allegation of violence or any kind of law breaking against the overwhelming majority of participants, and yet they are being reasonably deterred because who wants to face this kind of kidnapping and violence and injuries that are being meted out. And I say it's the worst of both worlds, because rather than bringing about law and order and peace and safety, the view from those on the ground, including the local law enforcement authorities, is that exactly the opposite occurred, that more violence and more disruption and chaos has been stirred up by the federal involvement. And some people are speculating that that may indeed have been the one of the major purposes for that involvement. So the ACLU a few days ago added to its initial complaint that the injunction should extend to all those who are participating on behalf of the federal government. And just yesterday, the judge granted that order as well. In addition, there are the Attorney General of Oregon has brought a lawsuit to enforce not only First Amendment rights, but Fourth Amendment rights to be free from unwarranted searches and seizures, which include this bodily seizure of the person. Fifth Amendment rights to have one's due process protected, because people are being deprived of liberty and being subjected to physical attack without any information at all about what the underlying alleged justification is, right? No notice, no opportunity to consult with a lawyer, no opportunity to defend themselves. And apparently there aren't even records being kept of when these people are arrested. So the you could teach a whole constitutional law course, sadly, about not only the individual rights that are being violated, but the violation of the most fundamental principles of our democratic republic, including federalism, which is so ironic because supposedly this is a federal government that believes in minimizing national power and maximizing so-called states' rights and rights of local authorities. And yet here, what is being done is in complete defiance and over the strong objection of the local authorities, as underscored by the fact that they even brought a lawsuit to try to end the federal involvement.
Professor Strassen raises issues of federalism. First of all, it makes me think that in the future, some future PhD, a historian is going to specialize in the year 2020. With that in mind, how unprecedented is this action on the part of the federal government policing in local jurisdictions, in particular in the case of Portland, without their consent?
It's not unprecedented. For sure. However, I think the combination of all the factors involved really make it feel very different than maybe some other interventions of the federal government. So typically when you see presidents rely on the military in domestic situations, it tends to be in three different types of scenarios. One, in times of economic distress. One, in times of political distress, particularly relating to race relations. And then third, in sort of a natural disaster type situations. And here, one could make the argument that we actually have the combination of all three of those things. We have economic distress, for sure, as a result of the COVID-19 situation, which one could view as a natural disaster. And then we also have political distress that is resulting from race relations. So when you have a combination of all of those three things, it really does feel different than maybe some other aspects of presidential use of the military in domestic situations in more historical times.
So Professor Meyer, the issue has been raised about how effective the use of this type of policing has been on the movement itself. You suggested that people were becoming a bit more galvanized, and what I find particularly fascinating in my own knowledge of social movements is the shifting of certain populations that typically would either sit out or oppose a movement, joining the movement because of state action. Is it fair to say we're seeing that, at least in Portland, happening, that people who were sitting this one out have decided, okay, I'm going to join the protests, and there could be a loyalty shift to the people out in the streets, because it's pretty clear to me that the president was hoping that the loyalty shift would be to the people at home, the so-called silent majority, those who are opposing the protests. So is this good for the movement that the federal government has taken this step?
Oh, it's bad for America. Let's just start with that. It's bad for America. It's the immediate effect, however, is to galvanize, polarize, divide, and inspire more activists to take to the streets. And one of the interesting things is the George Floyd protests, the wave of protests that swept across the streets in all of American cities, was immediately far more popular than anything you look back on and say, oh, that was historic. The March on Washington in 1963 had something like 24% public support. That's where Martin Luther King gave that I Have a Dream speech, 24%. George Floyd protests have like 60% support. And then when the police are coming out, when unidentifiable martial figures are coming out and policing the streets of Portland, it's forcing people, it's encouraging people to take sides, and it's not breaking the president's way, at least in Portland. It's bringing more people into the streets. So I mentioned that the Wall of Moms group, there's now wall of moms groups sprouting up in other cities around the country because women are inspired by these women of Portland. And the question is whether this polarization is part of Trump's plan all along. He knew he wasn't going to win Portland. He wasn't going to win Oregon. Maybe it inspires his base to get more and more engaged in this, you know, hostile race-baiting politics.
Professor Strassen.
I wanted to add that I certainly agree with David based on what I've read, that initially the protests were against the killing of George Floyd and for reform of the police. But then with the advent of these anonymous, really scary, secretive federal enforcers, the more demonstrators came out to demonstrate against those very tactics. But I also want to underscore that there is a group of would-be demonstrators who are being deterred from participating. We should not lose sight of that. And in fact, we convinced the federal judge of that, that is my ACLU colleagues, that some people, whether of a certain age or from family responsibilities, whatever, just had to value their own safety even above their political convictions. So let's not lose sight of the deterrent effect on some people's First Amendment rights.
Professor Celine?
Yeah, and I just wanted to say on the idea of increasing polarization, what I think is really interesting is because this is a federal issue, if you think about federalism as originally being designed to diffuse governmental power, both across the separation of powers, the three branches of government, and also between the federal and state governments. That's what the framers had in mind when they devised our constitutional system. But what has happened over time is that an increase in partisanship and the ability of the federal government to help to work with states as a result of federalism has allowed political competition to be channeled through the two parties as opposed to the branches of government and the federal and state governments fighting against each other. And so one of the results of this evolution of federalism and the way that it operates in our American system is that there has been an increase in partisanship. And then when you add in the just political dynamics and the dire stakes of today's environment, that just even increases the partisanship and the polarization even more.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing today the protests in Portland, sending in federal agents to try to break up those protests, the implications on civil liberties, and on federalism.
It's worth noting that Trump is hardly the first president to face mobilized opposition in the streets. George W. Bush did, Barack Obama did, every president back to George Washington has. And there's a standard recipe that presidents learn, which is that you say, I am trying to be the president for all Americans. I respect their right to protest, but I have to do what's best for all Americans. And that includes protecting their right to protest. And Obama knew that script. George W. Bush knew that script. They both tried to reach out to the opposition with not much success, but they tried. And Trump is going in exactly the opposite direction. He's saying that these Portlanders who are turning out in bicycle helmets, I think everybody in Portland has to wear a bicycle helmet. It's some sort of city ordinance. And saying that these people are un-American, Antifa, anarchists. And it just doesn't track to those of us who are watching all of it online. So the point about polarization is really dangerous, really important, and it's going to be something that's going to take a lot of time to recover from.
Professor Strassen.
I may be a starry-eyed optimist as an activist that's in my DNA, but I see at least on the part of civil society and academics, I see an enormous amount of consensus across the ideological spectrum about the dangers here I mean, genuine conservatives who want to reduce federal government power and constrain law enforcement are as deeply concerned as progressives who want to defend the right of these particular protesters, not to mention civil libertarians. And this is a wake-up call for all of us to see that Trump and his federal agencies, frighteningly, may well be acting within the bounds of legal authority that has been granted to presidents through laws that have been passed under administrations of both Democrats and Republicans. And there's just been this, to me as a civil libertarian, frightening aggregation of executive powers at the national level, not subject even to congressional oversight. And apparently a lot of it is authorized in secret. So maybe this will be a wake-up call to Congress to take a hard look at these powers that it has too easily given away.
One thing I thought about when both of you were talking, David, you sort of implied that there is a unwritten playbook that presidents have sort of followed up until President Trump. And Nadine, you were talking about the fact that legally this might be okay, but up until now there has been this unwritten playbook that people have been following. And I think it's worth noting that President Trump is the first of, I believe, either political party to, since the 1940s, to be nominated as the primary candidate without any governmental experience whatsoever. So it is possible that President Trump doesn't even know what the playbook is because he's never been exposed to it. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing at all. I'm just saying that I think that that's a reality. And that goes to Nadine's point about we need to really think about how much power the executive branch has, how much power each individual agency has, how much oversight Congress has over administrative agencies, how much oversight the judicial branch has over administrative agencies. So Congress has carved out exceptions to judicial review of various agency actions, and we need to think about that. There are so many things with respect to the administrative state and the executive branch as a whole that we really need to think about that we have not been forced to do recently because presidents have been operating under this playbook.
So the silver lining to the cloud. And I see that both the Department of Justice at U.S. and Department of Homeland Security Inspectors General have announced that they are going to be taking a close look at what's been going on. So that's one positive development.
Now, Professor Selene, I was thinking about with these federal authorities coming in, and it's been emphasized, they're not federal troops, not using the military, not using the National Guard. Apparently, it seems that the president is using Homeland Security, using ICE, these agencies that really are post 9/11 agencies, raising some interesting questions about their future. So first, is this exposing the fact that when you have these new agencies, it's easier to carve out roles for them because they don't have anywhere near as much history as to this is how they've traditionally been used, and raising some interesting questions, I think, from citizen activists, political activists, asking, do we really need a Department of Homeland Security? Do we really need an ICE or some of these other agencies that were responses to 9/11?
I have a question. Maybe Jennifer, you would know the answer to this question. Has any federal agency ever gone out of existence once it's created? I mean, it would seem that the bureaucratic inertia is just so huge. I remember after the Civil War ended, the ACLU was supporting a piece of legislation in Congress sponsored by Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan called End the Cold War at Home, to get rid of this whole architecture of, you know, surveillance powers and other restrictions on civil liberties that were ostensibly put in place just so we could win the Cold War. And we won the Cold War. And that piece of legislation never passed. The Espionage Act from the Red Scare era at the beginning of the 20th century still exists. I mean, is there any realistic hope that we would get rid of anything that's held up as being good for national security? security or necessary for national security?
Those who dislike the bureaucracy, unlike myself, who's dedicated her life to studying it.
You have a personal stake in its
that's
survival.
That's right. So I'm going to argue, So agencies do die, but they do tend to die when there's some sort of scandal. So, for example, the Minerals Management Service is kind of a classic example. Stories out about the employees just sort of sitting around watching porn and going out to...
I defend the right to do that.
That's right. Going out to dinner with the oil industry, sure. Instead of regulating, So there are examples. The Immigration and Naturalization Service obviously went out of existence and then was replaced by three different agencies in the Department of Homeland Security. So there are examples of agencies dying, but most of the time they do get replaced by something bigger and better. However, with respect to the question about DHS, it is a really interesting one. So agencies today, in the past, say, 10, 15 years, tend to be created with more specificity in legislation. So their initial authorizing statutes really specify many more structural details, including their relationship to the president and to Congress, than back even 50, 60 years ago. So that's a positive. But the negative, particularly with the Department of Homeland Security, is that in times of crisis, Congress tends to defer more to the executive branch. And so when the Department of Homeland Security was created, it was in this time of crisis. And so there was an idea of sort of giving the executive branch a little bit more authority than perhaps it would typically possess. And so with respect to all of the Department of Homeland Security's agencies, we're now left with this tension between really important national security concerns and really important civil liberties concerns. Mm-hmm. And we're not really sure where the balance should be, because at the time that the Department of Homeland Security and all of those agencies were created, public opinion, congressional opinion, executive opinion was firmly in the camp of national security.
Nadine Strassen.
At the very least, we would want whatever agencies and officials are interacting with, by and large, peaceful protesters, but even the occasional non-peaceful protester, to be trained for that purpose and to be knowledgeable about constitutional rights. And some of the agents and agencies that are interacting with the public in Portland reportedly are not in that category. They're Border Patrol agents that have a very different mandate, very different training. And one thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is that they are literally authorized to exercise investigative and arresting power within the hinterland of the United States, as long as it's within 100 miles of any border, which extends to Portland, right? Because the Pacific Ocean is a border. It extended to Washington, D.C., and in fact, it extends. I've read somewhere that it covers most people in the United States. And this is an agency that was never intended to be part of ordinary domestic law enforcement. I find that very troubling.
David, also, it seems to me that part of what the protests are about is about the increasing power of policing agencies, the defund the police, this question about abolishing ICE that had been raised in previous protest movements. So although Jennifer raises the question that we typically tend to see a deference of power to the executive in times of crisis, particularly in times of political crisis, isn't this political crisis a little bit different in that it's in part because we've been deferring so much to executive power and policing?
It's a crisis that's been mismanaged and polarized and politicized in ways that we didn't expect. So remember, the Black Lives Matter protests didn't start after George Floyd. Black Lives Matter started in 2013 after Trayvon Martin and the protection of Black bodies against the activities of mobs and police goes back over a century. So this is not new stuff. It's got more traction now because of the person who's sitting on top of it. And I think it's important for us to, you know, come back to Jennifer's point about like this guy who's president of the United States doesn't really understand how democracy works. And democracy's tough. Policing in a democracy is tougher than policing in an authoritarian state. Police and soldiers are supposed to be constrained by law. That's the way America is supposed to work. The police in Portland are supposed to go out there and protect even really heinous opinions being expressed. That's their job. And it's hard. And they're doing it very, very poorly. Trump is not respectful of this very notion that people who don't like you, who are protesting against you, are every bit as protected, decent, and American as the people who like you. And this has become a challenge for the entire nation. In terms of defunding the police, I think that we've been in this position for at least 40 years where there's been tons of money for the military, a lot of money in localities for police, but schools are shutting down or overcrowded. Social welfare has been severely constrained. The minimum wage is lower than it's been since, I think, 1967. So people are struggling. And there's a democratic battle about priorities. That's a pretty reasonable political battle to have. That's the kind of arguments that democracies are supposed to have. And it takes place when it takes place in protest politics on placards rather than in debating societies. So it often gets oversimplified.
Jennifer?
So when we were talking about the transfer of power to the executive branch, we tend to think about transfer of power to the executive branch, and we think of President Trump. But this is also occurring at the state level as well. So when we're talking about who the actors are, the key players in these scuffles, it's a mayor, executive branch, the governor, executive branch. Police, most of the time, are under the purview of the executive branch. Even defunding the police and allocating programming to other administrative agencies at the state level, that is, by definition, an executive function. And so we need to think about that, too. A lot of times, President Trump gets the rap for transferring lots of power to the executive branch at the federal level, but we also see that going on at the state level as well.
And this is David, and those guys are targets. I mean, governing is becoming harder and harder. So I see people in the grocery store taking off their masks and asserting what they claim are their constitutional rights. And they're targeting my governor, Gavin Newsom, who says he's doing stuff on behalf of public health. So there's some delicate balancing and difficult things to sort out. And I don't think that most Americans know word one of that First Amendment and how and what abusive authority and what constitutional rights are. Constitutional right doesn't mean anything that you don't like.
Yes,
Here for more education about First Amendment rights, and for starting with the President of the United States. But I actually wanted to make a point that even before the year 2020 with the pandemic and the racial justice protests, we were having a crisis in attempts to suppress rights of protesters over the last several years. There's just been a rash of laws that have been proposed and even passed by state legislatures all across the country, presumably in reaction to what the most predominant protests had been, which included a lot on environmental issues, on gun violence issues, on pipeline, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, the women's marches. So there's been an ongoing effort to thwart the rights of people to express views that those who wield political power find uncongenial. And yet, by definition, it is precisely those who lack political power that are most dependent on the right of peaceful protest to get their message across. You know, the crackdown in Oregon, in Portland, is part of a much larger, much longer lasting pattern.
When we come back, the implications on democracy, civil liberties, and the protest movement seeking change across American cities as federal troops occupy Portland and refuse to leave. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Local governments have demanded that federal troops occupying Portland leave. Ununiformed troops have seized protesters off the streets and detained them in unmarked vans. We discuss the implications on democracy, civil liberties, and the protest movement seeking change across American cities. Doug Becker explores.
David, one thing about, broadly about social movements and the definition of the type of movements, and there's a lot of research done on the effectiveness of violent versus nonviolent movements. And one of the issues that I find particularly fascinating is the way in which violence has been defined politically. What I mean by this is the president, or at least seemingly out of the White House, the argument for why they sent in federal agents was the protection of federal property and the description of graffiti as violence as opposed to the free speech. How concerned should we be at sort of broadening this definition of violence to include spray painting a political message on a federal building, or this equating of this violence property with violence against people?
Well, we should be very concerned about it. That was kind of a softball question. Should we be concerned? Yes, we should be concerned about that, Douglas, because it's very severe. And when we look back at the protesters of the past who we now heroicize, like the late John Lewis, he was not popular when he was getting beaten. People thought he was disruptive and destructive. And they did not, necessarily admire his determined nonviolence. The moment that, there's any reason for optimism, and there is a little bit of reason for optimism, is it's that the audience is important in a social confrontation in Portland. The audience is even more important than the people who are battling in the streets. And what's happening so far is far greater public scrutiny and opposition to the young men in camouflage than the moms with the moms in yellow or the dads with leaf blowers. And so even if the courts or the president are not making the distinctions that you ask for, that you appropriately ask for, the American public is.
I just wanted to clarify that writing a message on a piece of government property is not protected free speech. So it could indeed be penalized as vandalism, but it is not violence, and the level of overreaction to relatively petty property crime is very troubling. Bring in all this massive firepower and use tactics of violence, tear gas and rubber bullets and so forth.
Hey, Jennifer?
Yeah, and I would like to say that on that point, if we look at when the courts have historically upheld citizens' rights over the right of the president to send in military and domestic situations, they seem to have carved out three exceptions, three times where the courts will side more with individual rights. And it seems that in this particular scenario, we could fall within all three of those. So the first is when civilian law enforcement officials make a directive use of military investigators, and we don't really know what's going on in terms of who's operating on the ground. The second is when the use of the military pervades the activities of civilian officials. And one could argue that it seems like in this particular scenario, the use of the military is really pervading the actions of police officials who would potentially maybe issue a citation for graffiti as opposed to put people in unmarked vans and cart them away. And then the third is when the military is used to subject citizens to military power that is regulatory, prescriptive, or compulsory in nature. Again, seems to be that in the Portland scenario, we're brushing up against all three of those things that, at least precedent-wise, the courts have really been uncomfortable with when it comes to presidential use of the military.
So, David, there's been speculation. The protests in Portland were winding down. They've certainly become much more energized as a result of this presidential action. Does it appear as though the protests in Portland are going to continue fairly indefinitely, or at least over the course of the next few months? Or is there likely to be an expectation that they're going to eventually start to wind down as they've seemed to wind it down in a number of cities?
The thing that's stopping them from winding down right now is aggressive policing. I mean, I know Nadine wants to focus on the people who are deterred from going out in the streets. Yeah, I'm sure there are some people like that, but there are other people who are going out in the streets because it's become a free speech issue. Mm-hmm. So that's piece one. Piece two, because the protesters have found some successful innovations to make it more difficult for the police to control the street, not the police, the armed forces of some sort to control the streets. Their job is getting harder, and in a democracy, it's hard from the start. So if tear gas doesn't work to control the streets quite as quickly anymore, what are they going to escalate to? More flashbangs, more rubber bullets, more beatings? And how do we deter people from going out in the streets? I think the best way to deter people from going out in the streets is to convince them that there's something else they can do that's going to be more effective, to open up democratic institutions more. That is not happening at this moment. The other way to get people out of the streets, which they know very well in authoritarian settings, is to make it impossible for people to be out in the streets safely, to kill people. And I hope that doesn't happen here, but it's happened before. And more aggressive policing of the streets of Portland could also momentarily put a stop to this, and it will come at a tremendous cost to human life. So when I see those moms out there with, you know, eighth grade lab goggles or swimming goggles, I know that they can stand up against tear gas for just a little while. And I don't know how frustrated those guys in camouflage are going to get and what they're going to do next. And it's a little bit scary.
Yes, Nadine. Do you see these protests continuing? Do you share David's concerns about the effects this can have on the protesters?
I agree with David. I was racking my brain as to whether there are any pending legislative proposals either at the state or city level in Portland or Oregon more generally might. I just haven't been following that. So if there were some serious reform of police practices that people could organize and mobilize behind, that might be. I don't want to lose the energy, by the way. I would like to siphon it into ways that are going to be even more constructive in terms of addressing the really serious problems. By the way, Portland has had a history, not only as David mentioned, of police abuse, but of real racism, Portland and the whole state of Oregon. So channeling to constructive reform would be wonderful, but I haven't been following the politics. I don't know how likely or how imminent that would be.
Now, Jennifer, I know one of the reasons why the Portland case is so interesting is also because it's clearly being used as a precedent by the administration with the threats to send the same, you know, types of federal agents to places like Chicago. You know, I would imagine Louisville could be another place where they might send that. First of all, are we likely to see a replay of this in other cities, or is the nature of these protests going to make the president less likely to use this tool in other cities, which, by the way, always seem to be dominated by Democratic mayors?
Yeah, I think the last point that you made there is the thing that makes me most uncomfortable, is that it seems to be in bigger cities that traditionally are Democratic, and that just makes me squirm a little bit on the inside. However, I'll point out, in the interest of fairness, President Trump is not the first president to tout law and order in an election year. And I think it's fairly common, and in particular for Republican presidents in the modern era who like to play on the idea that the Democratic Party is soft on crime and that this has a potential to affect many citizens in various ways who tend to be the ones that vote for Republican candidates. And so this narrative that President Trump is telling is not that different from previous Republican presidents in the modern era. What is different is the implementation of his going beyond rhetoric, going beyond forming a task force or, you know, announcing a new policy, but actually going into the streets. And to be 100% honest, that makes me very uncomfortable.
Professor Meyer.
I think you're right, Jennifer. And I think hauling out some classic political science, there's something called the rally around the flag of a fact for a commander-in-chief in crisis, particularly sending troops abroad and finding external threats. So we remember in 2018, there was this caravan that we kept hearing about that was marching from Mexico, marching from Mexico, marching from Mexico. Somehow it was going to arrive right after Election Day, and it never quite got here because the election took place. This time, instead of sending troops abroad, Trump is sending troops to attack Americans and trying to generate the same rally around the flag effect. And the politics of race play out in an odd way here, because most of those people in Portland that are getting beaten and gassed are white, and they look white. They have that like pasty Northwestern look, you know, wearing flannel.
Professor Strassen.
But the other cities that are on Trump's wish list all have very substantial Black populations. And there are such racial overtones with the law and order mantra during my lifetime, which goes back to Richard Nixon invoking that and through the Willie Horton allusions and so forth.
So Jennifer, I mean, that kind of raises an interesting question. Is the president choosing Portland in part because it can blunt some of the criticisms that this is completely racially motivated, that instead it's really about trying to take on this group that I'm going to ask David about in just a moment, if he can explain what Antifa is, because I'm not exactly sure, you know, what it is. Is there a political peril sending troops, authorities to cities that are not quite as white as Portland?
I think that's an excellent question. And to be 100% honest, it's very hard for me, even as an executive politics scholar, to really truly understand how much strategy is involved in the Trump administration. I do know that he has surrounded himself with people who are highly strategic. And so I think it is not out of the realm of possibility that Portland provides a very interesting case that could potentially open the door for a more problematic cases. For example, I grew up in Baltimore, a city that has its own history and would fall within this category as well. I think it's an interesting question. And I think it's also worth noting all of this is happening at a time where President Trump is really divorced from his base in terms of his ability to interact with them in the same way that he has traditionally done over the course of his presidency. And so I do think, regardless of how strategic he is and how strategic his administration and his advisors and his campaign is, it is very difficult in this particular moment in time to really have a good grasp of where public opinion and where each individual candidate's base is. And it seems to be changing fairly rapidly over the course of the past few months. And I can imagine that would be very disconcerting as someone who's running for office, especially someone who like Trump, who really, really gets his energy and his ideas based on things like rallies and interacting with constituents in this kind of brazen, rah-rah type of situation. And if he can't feel that energy, then it would be very disconcerting in terms of how one should act. And I think you see that playing out in terms of his interactions most recently, say in Portland, say resuming the Corona task force briefings minus the task force, you know, those sorts of things. So
as promised, David, I am going to ask you, since it's been cited so often that those in Portland, the protesters are, at times they'll call them anarchists, but frequently Antifa. I get asked this question frequently, what is Antifa? Now that I have you, specialist in social movements, can you give me a good answer for what is Antifa?
Okay, first let me give you the citation. The book on Antifa is written by a guy named Mark Bray. So you can read more about Antifa there. The short answer is Antifa is a set of beliefs more than an organization. And the belief is that it's important to confront fascism and fascist movements as they first emerge. And there are scattered outcroppings of Antifa actions in the United States and in Europe. And they're really, really scattered and small. Berkeley has a number of young people who will turn out for Antifa. Portland has a number of people who will turn out for particular events. And Antifa was present. Antifa activists, self-identified, were present in Charlottesville. And there were a group of clergy there who said if it weren't for the Antifa activists, they would have been hurt or killed. So it's a mixed bag in that regard. And then they come out and give publicity to hack authors in Berkeley who go there to get protested against to sell their books. But Antifa is small, scattered belief, a set of beliefs, and it's a mobilization in a moment. And there's no membership list, there's no organization, there's nobody who's authorized to make statements on its behalf or endorsements in elections. And it's a very convenient terror for conservatives to haul out and to inflate.
So last question, I'll start with Nadine. With us watching what's been going on in Portland and a number of us concerned about these issues, what can we do other than donating to causes or joining movements ourselves? Is there anything we as citizens, and the obvious, which is to vote, what can be done to try to counter some of these actions on the part of the administration?
I would say, you know, don't take for granted, vote, vote, vote. Unfortunately, too many people don't do that. That is a huge step, and not voting has a huge impact. People have to be aware of that. You know, a number of organizations have information and petitions that people can sign that can galvanize action on the part of elected officials at all levels of government. I've mentioned, of course, the American Civil Liberties Union. There are others. And as has come up in our conversation, there is so much reform that is called for, no matter who is president, no matter who is governor or mayor, because as Jennifer said, there's a lot of accumulated executive power at all levels of government. And I think that this is a kind of issue that could and should appeal across the ideological spectrum, making sure that we preserve just the structural separation of powers, checks and balances, federalism that was designed to minimize an accumulation of power that can limit the rights of us individuals. All of us should be able to get behind that. And popular support is really important in getting elected officials to, they do respond to constituent pressure.
Jennifer, is the response to the actions on the part of this administration likely to produce some sort of rolling back on executive power? Or is this going to be seen as kind of idiosyncratic to this specific president? So if we have, say, a President Biden, we're going to be potentially right back in the same position of a continuing accumulation of executive power?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think that this presidency will, regardless of whether it lasts 4 years or eight, will be viewed as a different type of presidency. And I think that if Joe Biden were to win in November, I don't think that executive power is going away. I think it will just be used in a different way. And that's something to be aware of, and that's something that citizens should be aware of, and it's something that quite frankly, I mean, I teach all of my classes touch on the bureaucracy, and imagine teaching students about the bureaucracy, everybody's eyes glaze over, and they just like pass out in their seats, right? Everyone thinks of the bureaucracy and the administrative state is boring, but it actually has a huge impact on our daily lives. And similarly, I am guilty of this, federalism. I hated federalism in middle school, high school, college, law school, and grad school. I've done it all and hated it in all levels. And it wasn't until I started actually seeing the power of the state and local governments and what they actually do. So I myself am guilty of thinking that state and local governments are kind of, bit players, and the real interesting stuff happens at the national level, as my research suggests. But in reality, if we're thinking about how to make real change in our daily lives, it starts at the local and state level. And that's the place where citizens can have the most impact, but for some reason are the least engaged, on average. And so I think that if there's something to be taken away from this particular moment in time, it would be that getting involved in your state and local government is actually really important and can make meaningful change in both your life and your neighbors' lives.
Thank you all very much. This issue clearly is one that has extensive implications for democracy, for federalism, and certainly should be and likely will be one of the more important issues in the 2020 presidential election and beyond. Thank you for your insights. Our panel today was David Meyer, Professor of Sociology, Political Science and Planning, Policy and Design at the University of California, Irvine. He is the author of The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. Nadine Strossen, John Marshall Harlan II, Professor Emerita at New York Law School and the former president of the American Civil Liberties Union. She's the author of Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. And Jennifer Celine, Kinder Institute Assistant Professor of Constitutional Democracy at the University of Missouri. She is the author of The Best Laid Plans, How Administrative Burden Complicates Voting Rights Restoration Law and Policy.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.